This is Photo Geek Weekly, episode 15, recorded on February 24th, 2018. I'm your host, Don Komarechka, to guide you through the geekiest topics that we can come up with on a weekly basis that are related to the photographic industry. And there are some doozies this week, I think. We're going to talk about sensors from Sony and Panasonic, some new technology there, some changes to how Google lets you view images through their image search. DP Review has an article on the Fujifilm X-H1, but I'm sure it's pretty much covered everywhere. We want to talk about the new flagship camera from Fuji. And a bonus story at the very end, Kodak is doing something that surprises me a little bit, but I'm very happy about. So to go through all of these stories, I have in the co-pilot seat today, the first repeat guest host, Mike Howard. I guess you did a good enough job to come back again. You didn't scare everybody away. Awesome. Mike, how you doing?
Awesome. Thanks for having me back, Tom. I'm glad to be back and glad to be the first repeat.
And Mike, a lot of people might know you from the JPEG to RAW podcast. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you do other stuff as well, but that's where we first connected.
Right.
And you've had me on, geez, how many times?
Four times, yes. And at least two of those times are some of our most popular videos from the whole time we've been doing this. And we're going on 7 years now. One was the macro show, mm-hmm. which is still hugely popular. And the other one was infrared.
Well, and you might get a little bump on the macro one because it's available to search on YouTube. And I saw it because 2 days ago I recorded with Tony and Chelsea Northrop in their TNC Live, which they've got a very big audience. And I'm very honored to have been a part of that conversation. And I saw in the related videos, the JPEG to RAW episode on macro photography was in there. So awesome. People are searching this stuff out. And I will say, though, with that TNC Live, I have never seen a stream of YouTube comments that were so positive and polite. That just made my day for that. So I appreciate the positive feedback that everybody has been giving there. And hopefully some of those people are listening now. Before we get into all of the news that we talked about, before we started recording, Mike, you were making me quite envious about the weather that you have there in Atlanta. What's going on?
It is fantastic. Spring is definitely in the air. We're in the mid to low 70s, and I went out for a walk this morning, like I was mentioning, and there is just life everywhere. You know, all the animals are looking for their spring mates and preparing their, you know, for that, and just life was blooming everywhere. It's just a wonderful time. I love this time.
And see, I'm waiting for that. I'm waiting for the crocuses and the snowdrops and all of the other early spring flowers to come up, because I want to take them into my studio and shine some ultraviolet light on them, see if they glow, or just play around and experiment with some of this stuff. I'm still doing my snowflake series right now for those that are following that. And it's getting into the final stretch, but at this point in the game, when I'm in that final month of it, you know, I don't wish for it to be over, but I'm looking past it at this point. I'm very excited about what's going to come next.
Now, I thought you used to only do that for 1 month, right?
Well, I've always done it every day from December 1st, but the last 2 years, come Christmas Day, I slow down and I do it every other day because my bandwidth is limited now with our daughter who's 20 months old now, and she's a huge handful in the best possible ways, mind you, but there's just less time on a consistent basis to do it. But yeah, every other day since Christmas, I've been putting out a snowflake, and it takes 4 to 5 hours of editing plus writing the post and everything else. So it is half of my workflow is just that one project. I had 150 unanswered emails today. And when my daughter went down for a nap, I just said, okay, inbox zero mode. Let's just see how far we can get. I got down to 95. So let's keep that good ship going.
Well, as one of your followers, I appreciate all of her work. I love seeing that in my Twitter feed. And well, you also post on Facebook too, right?
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, of course, Google+, Flickr, and 500px. Everywhere. Yeah.
So I enjoy being able to see all those. I didn't recall what the time frame was, but it seems like I'm seeing them all the time, and I'm always amazed by that work.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mike. And what kind of work have you been up to lately?
I've been more work. My day job has been sucking up a lot of my time lately. So that's been my biggest thing that I've been working on right now. About to send off, I have a D500 camera that I'm having to send back because it has not taken a single sharp image. And no really? amount of fine-tune adjustments has done anything to fix it.
Now, we're talking the autofocus system Correct. Is just malfunctioning, right. or is it just like an issue like your lens mount is bent?
Well, I'm hoping it's not the lens mount. I can't tell that it's bent, but it's brand new. It was brand new. It's just from day one. With any lens I put on it, will not take a sharp image, even with going maximum either way with the fine-tune adjustment.
Now, have you this is for autofocus. Yeah. So have you tried manually focusing the lens in order to just see if you can get a clear shot in
yes.
there?
Yes, and I can get one then, yeah.
Yeah, so clearly it's the autofocus yeah. system that is out of whack. You know, I've had issues. I don't shoot Nikon, but I've got a lot of students, of course, that shoot Nikon, and I'll clean the occasional Nikon camera sensor. Nikon cameras, for whatever reason, and some of them that don't even have declared issues, like their flagship bodies, I've had at least two Nikon, one was a D3S and one was a D4, that had oil spots on the sensor. Mm. And I mean, I've got the equipment to clean yeah. it, but I was just surprised because I haven't seen that from Canon cameras or anybody else. And it's an easy fix. And the people that had the issue didn't report back and say that it returned. But Nikon, I think, has some quality control concerns, more so than most.
I have heard of those oil spots on some of the cameras before. I haven't had that problem myself. But this is the first time I've had a Nikon camera that would cause this problem with the focusing. And even, they built in the auto fine-tune adjustments that you can do to it so that you could, from lens to lens, make some adjustments where it was front focusing or back focusing. And as long as it was within the specs of what it could handle in those adjustments, you should be fine. In my case, it wasn't. So your first thing you suspect is, one, your technique. Two, you suspect the lens. But when it's every lens, now it's not the lens.
Well, here's an interesting consideration. If and Nikon, Canon, pretty much everybody has these micro adjustments now. I've heard of people saying, I bought a new camera body and it's just not focusing the way that my other one was. Everything just seems a little bit soft. And so I got a bad copy of the camera. But what might have been the case, and this is, I think, an article from Lens Rentals, was that all of their lenses were off and their camera was also off. And it just so happened that they actually meshed together well. So when they bought a new camera, their new camera was actually perfectly fine, but all of the lenses were so far off that it matched, and now it doesn't. So if you have like a zero level modification on the micro adjustment for one lens and like one that sways vastly out of whack, then it means that one of those lenses is wrong. It might not be the one that's at zero, though, because the camera could be that point of error as well. But it could happen both ways.
Yeah, that's a rabbit hole I hope I don't have to go down, because then you never know which thing is really off.
Right. Let's hope it's just the camera. You can get that fixed, and then everything picks up from there. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the stories today. We're talking about cameras already, and I mentioned cleaning camera sensors. But, that is a terrible segue to sensors, which we have some news from both Sony and from Panasonic this past week. Now, we'll start with the Sony news, and they have a pretty groundbreaking new sensor technology. I'm going to say it's in prototype form because this is a 1.46 megapixel sensor, which is not going to make it into any product that I will buy, at least not intentionally. Maybe the backup camera on a car or something might feature a resolution of that size. But this is a CMOS sensor with a global shutter. And what that means is a global shutter is where everything gets read out instantly at the same time. And in order to accomplish this, Sony has done something that I thought would have been either technically impossible or at the very least cost prohibitive, where they have pretty much built pixel parallel analog to digital converters. So for every pixel on the sensor, there is an ADC that takes the signal from the sensor technology and converts it into the ones and zeros that get written to the file for every single pixel on the sensor. The current way to do this is you read them out in rows or columns, depending on the orientation. And so in that case, you've got this rolling shutter effect, where if you've got something really fast moving, the common example is like the propeller of an airplane, that it will have this really wiggly, warpy, kind of cool effect, but it's not accurate to reality. It has to do with how the sensor is read off. But if everything can be read at the same time, that problem goes away. Mike, what do you think about this new tech? Is it innovative enough to be impressive on that merit alone, or do we need to see more value in it than just fixing propeller blades?
I want to see more value in it than just fixing propeller blades. I think it's a cool effect when you see the rolling shutter. If you didn't care that it happened, I mean, like even the one that's on the ground, the picture that's in the article of the plane on the ground where it looks like there's just spare blades flying in the air, not even attached to the propeller. That is a cool effect. Now, if you weren't trying to get that, it's a problem. But I'm interested in the next article more than this one. But this one, I think it's interesting if they can make that cost effective to have that and bump up the megapixels. But for me, the rolling shutter has not been that big of an issue. I want to see things like lower noise and more dynamic range.
Well, you will probably get both of those with this sensor technology as well. Lower noise because it's a single readout. And so a noise would be isolated to a pixel rather than a line. So you wouldn't have these weird noise lines running across an image, which you see oftentimes when you push your ISO well beyond its design threshold. But they give you higher options for marketing terms. Here's something of value when you have a single readout on a per pixel basis. I remember it was MIT, I think. There was a group of grad students that came up with a prototype or at least a concept of a sensor that would, when it hits its peak value for a pixel, read that out and reset itself during the exposure itself. And so it would just increment a counter by one, and that would then, refill up whatever that electron bucket is that's collecting information. And then if it hits its peak again, it would, read that out to zero and increase the counter to two, and so on and so forth. So what happens now with digital cameras is you can't have a per pixel control because it's being read out in lines. So that's not a possibility. But if you could have some sort of memory in the analog to digital converter and design it in such a way that you could read out in real time and reset it while the exposure is actually happening, then your dynamic range goes through the roof. Because you no longer have clipped highlights ever, because it just resets that that bucket of information and says, okay, well, whatever this gets up to in its 14-bit signal, add a series of all ones behind it, and so we have all of that information still contained.
That sounds incredible.
It's a possibility. I have no idea if that's going to be built into the Sony tech, but it becomes something that is within the realm of, a down-the-line sort of addition to this technology, only possible when you're looking at the conversion on a pixel-by-pixel basis. So there's that.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. You got this story, you got the next one coming out with Panasonic.
Well, why don't you lead us into that then, Mike?
Yeah, the Panasonic one is also a global shutter, but they've hit, 8K?
They've hit 8K resolution. That's really big. That's, 36 megapixels or something of that
nature? Yeah, and if I was reading this right, they also have, the way they're doing it is with an organic sensor versus CMOS, which gives all kind of, not only the global shutter, but also gives them the ability to almost have like a built-in ND filter function.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. And they have different modes, one that would record brightness properly and the other one that would record saturation with more accuracy. Mm-hmm. There's lots of interesting ways you can bend and twist that sort of tech to the whim of getting a better image. Now, you'd have to understand exactly what's going on with the technology from an engineering standpoint on Adobe's side to read that information properly. It would probably be a similar raw file. By the looks of the diagrams I saw, both of these new sensors are using a Bayer filter, a color filter array to figure out color information. The organic layer within this sensor does not subvert that or change it in any way. But I'm... The only hesitation I have on this is some of the issues that I've seen with OLED displays, and the O in that stands for organic. They don't stay consistent over time. There's been burn-in issues with some OLED smartphones, and I worry about the longevity of that. It's not as big of a deal when it's a display, but when it's the image capture surface itself that might get out of whack or have particular burn-in issues or change or fade or not be consistent over time, they definitely have to overcome that. That is one of those big roadblocks for me, that if my sensor is going to be perfect for 6 months and then I have to either recalibrate it or send it in for service, that's a non-starter. A generation one product might have that. And so we might have to live through that for the first cameras that use that. But I'm thinking to myself, Panasonic as a sensor manufacturer, I mean, they don't usually ring in my head as somebody that makes sensors. We hear Sony, of course, they make Nikon sensors and a lot of mobile platform stuff. I thought Panasonic was out of this industry. And aside from industrial applications, this worries me because there was a lot of patents sought after for this. Was it 135 Japanese patents and 83 overseas patents? This puts this into dangerous territory for me because it means that if Panasonic doesn't have an entrenched buyer base for existing manufacturers, aside from themselves, right, then the tech could be only into Panasonic. Or if they're not even making their own sensors for their digital cameras, which they are great sensors, by the way, but I just don't know who manufactures them, then this could be something of a niche product that never catches on because nobody else can recreate it. And having over 200 patents associated with it, there would be some pretty steep licensing fees if anybody wanted to use the tech or purchase it from Panasonic. But again, they're not known for making their camera sensors. This could be a turning point for them, hopefully a good one, but it is worrisome. Who else does obscure niche sensors? I'm thinking of Foveon, and they're used in Sigma's cameras. And I might get an email from one person listening to this that has a Sigma camera because their market share is almost non-existent. It is a really cool bit of technology that instead of using a color filter array that is separated out, it's overlaying. So the red, green, and blue are over top of each other, and every pixel actually gets a proper RGB value associated with it. We don't have that in any of our cameras.
It's interesting. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, continue. No, I've blabbered enough.
I was going to say, it's interesting you bring up the Foveon sensor because I remember it had to be a decade ago or more. My neighbor, when I was out shooting, whatever, my neighbor comes up and was talking to me about this new tech coming out from Sigma or whoever it was that has this new sensor that was going to put Nikon and Canon out of business, was basically what he was saying. And it was this Foveon technology that was going to take over the entire market. And it does, it sounds impressive. You know, it sounds like, yeah, that is good technology. That may be the future of where we're going. And like you said, you talked today, how many people are using a Foveon sensor right now?
And it probably comes down to patents and licensing. Yep. And because they did not get a high volume distribution, they couldn't reiterate the product fast enough. The latest ones are great. There's no question about that. But you can only find them on Sigma cameras, the Quattro line of cameras, which again is such a small piece of the market that the R&D put into the next generation of that is going to be maybe not non-existent, but it's not going to keep pace with the new stuff that we're seeing from Sony and Panasonic. So let's just hope that Panasonic does not end up in the same boat. I really hope that this new sensor technology overcomes any initial hurdles. Clearly, they can do it on a large scale. And with this organic compound, using that as the trick for a global shutter, I think that's a brilliant solution. So, more power to them. Wish the best. But this is not in any products that we can get our hands on right now and not for the foreseeable future. So it looks like Panasonic might be closer to having a viable product because this is being showed off as an 8K sensor that is far enough down the pipeline that it can be announced and shown off to the world. So interesting times we live in. I wonder what product that would first show up in, whether it would be a broadcast camera, a consumer camera, something industrial. time will tell.
Yeah. I mean, they even provided samples, which I don't think was in the Sony article, right?
Right. I didn't see any samples from Sony. And the samples from Panasonic were really promising. Mm-hmm. The dynamic range that it was capable of to pull detail out of shadows and keep the highlights from blowing out. I think that was a wonderful kind of sneak peek into what we're going to be seeing as the photography industry evolves. And as that industry evolves, we see it from another perspective as well. This week, we got news that Google has indeed removed the image button, the view image button from their image search. And this might not be a huge deal for some, but Mike, I know you covered this on your JPEG to RAW podcast. And so I want to give you first word on this to dive into this and what it means to you.
You know, you share a lot of your hard work online. We were just talking about that earlier, how you share all this work. So, you know, and people, I'm sure, steal that from you. And, you know, it's a big thing for photographers that a lot of our work is stolen. Some of it by people you may not care if they steal, like, you know, maybe a third grader uses it for a project. You probably don't care. Person who goes and prints it, or, you know, somebody who resells it is a whole different ballgame. But somebody who prints it and puts it on a wall, and you'd like them to buy it from you. Getty and Google were having a battle, court case, going back and forth on, you know, what Google was doing was having that view image there where you could get the image without actually having to go to the web page. And therefore, you thought maybe you were getting a royalty-free image that you can use to do whatever you want, and you never were able to, you never went to the actual website to see who the photographer was and if there's any copyright or anything like that. And they settled out of court, and Google decided to just remove the view image. I'm not sure how much that stops, because you can still just right-click on it and save it to your desktop.
Yeah. And, you know, I've disabled right-clicking on my website itself. So if you were to click on Visit Site, and view my own website and try to right click and save on it, you won't be able to do that. Yeah. So I did not like that you could just click and view the image and circumvent that.
Right.
But I'm kind of appalled by the way Google behaves in terms of defining an image that might be in the public domain versus one that is clearly associated with somebody else's copyrights. There is a checkbox that you can go in and check. It's buried in the advanced settings, scroll way down, and there's a drop-down box that will allow you to show only images that are free for you to use for any purpose. And there's a few different options within that, depending on what you're looking for. Nobody does that. Yeah. You have to be educated on copyright and what it means for you to even go looking for that. And the general public is not educated that way, and they won't be. So you have to be proactive about it. Instead of just saying, okay, you know, slap on the wrist, you know, you can't click on this view image button, I think Google needs to more clearly label in their search that these images are likely copy protected. Not just saying these images may or may not be blah, 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 some fine print in the bottom that is, you know, a slightly different shade of gray compared to the different colored background so that it's hard to see. Yes, there's a disclaimer there, but it needs to be right front and center. And until that happens, I think this is just a stepping stone towards that, and I'll take this as a win. Mm-hmm. But my images get stolen all the time. And you mentioned, kids in school. I did a presentation to a high school in my area recently, and my image was infringed in the classroom that I was speaking in. They had a contest or a project where they had to make these little name tags and their name and blah, blah, a quick little phrase or something about it, and put an image in the background. And all these kids just went online and found the first image that they wanted. And a bunch of them were my maple leaf flag photograph, which is red maple leaves on a bed of white snow in the shape of the Canadian flag. And, you know, of course, I pointed it out. And it was from a class from the year prior. So, I mean, I wasn't shaming anybody directly in the audience, but people are uneducated to this, and ignorance is no defense.
You know, going back a few years when Napster came out, a lot of us went out there and got lots of free music. But over the years, you know, we probably knew it was wrong. Oh, let's just say we knew it was wrong then. But I think that, you know, we've been a little better educated now and realized, you know, you should not be stealing music. And there's other ways to get music and do that kind of thing. And with movies, the same thing. You know, you shouldn't be stealing movies. So I think people, when you do that, you I think people in their mind either have said, I don't care, and they just do it anyway, but they know it's wrong. Somehow with photos, that message, we've not been successful in getting that to the general public.
And this is weird too, because if you're stealing movies or music, I mean, you're typically, robbing profits from a big record label or a big movie studio. But when you steal photographs, you are preventing a photographer, a business of one, an artist, from making a living from their own work. And that message should, I think, be spoken a little bit more clearly. But for whatever reason, we kind of bundle that all up together and say, in the anonymousness of the internet, that anything that you find on there must be free. So steps in the right direction here. I'm very happy for it. And, I'll maybe write a stern letter to Google to see if they will take further action. But if it took Getty at a high-level court case to make any progress, I think my opinion will fall on deaf ears. Speaking of the image industry that we're in, it is evolving. It's constantly changing. And, the way we consume and view images are all, there's new ways to see photographs all the time. I finally decided I was going to put my money down on the new Red Hydrogen smartphone, which is $1,100 or $1,500. Wow. For a different version of it. I went for the more expensive one that's made of titanium. But it's supposed to have a, quote, holographic display. I don't think it's actually holographic, but some really cool 3D display tech that doesn't require glasses. And they promise the ability to record that content as well. So we'll probably talk about this more when I actually get one in my hands. Yeah. But hey, there's innovation all around to work on. Speaking of that, too, we've got the next story up. Story number three is Fuji has announced their new flagship camera, first in a series, the X-H1. And so this is stills and very powerful movie features with something that Fuji previously said that they couldn't do is put in-body image stabilization in their cameras. And this has it. So I know you've taken a look through the specs of this camera, Mike. Does it get you excited?
Yeah, I'm a Nikon person. I'm not going to switch to Fuji, but I love the advances they've made here and that in-camera stabilization. I know that Sony has it in some of their cameras. I wish Nikon would bring it to theirs. I think it gives like 5.5 stops with that stabilization, which is just fantastic. And basically, you have that in the camera. You don't need it in a lens anymore. It makes all your lenses image stabilized. So,
If I've got a nice prime lens, like my 50 millimeter, my 24 millimeter prime lenses, they're great lenses, but they're not image stabilized. And if I could immediately get more usefulness out of that equipment, I'm all for it.
I love that Fuji in this case and Sony, they're out there pushing the envelope and they're adding new features and really going to push Nikon and Canon, and for me, mainly Nikon, to do things that they wouldn't have done at the same pace, without that push.
I think everybody is really pushing forward here, except for Canon and Nikon. Sony, we clearly see what they're doing, and they've been doing it for a long time, and I think they're the most obvious. But Fuji, they decided to beat to their own drum with their X-Trans color filter array in front of their sensors. Now, this uses the same sensor, by the way, as the X-T2, which is a much applauded camera sensor, 24 megapixels. But the camera built around the sensor is far more capable. And so it's got a higher resolution electronic viewfinder. The 4K video features are vastly improved. I mean, this is phenomenal what it can do, not only in terms of recording length, which has been lengthened, but the bit rate that it gets recorded at, as well as a log function, which can be much more friendly if you're working with other cameras and you're trying to edit this into a larger piece. So that's great. It's a sturdier camera. And there's a lot of extra bells and whistles, including just a top LCD screen that is really high class, and it's reminiscent of stuff that might be on a flagship camera from Canon or Nikon. Mm-hmm. And it costs $1,899 US.
That was
so
good too, yeah.
I see that price and I'm thinking, okay, what does Canon have? Canon has the 60 Mark II at that price point, which is a full frame camera, and that's a different, but it's slower in every way. It has no 4K capabilities if you're into video, and a lot of people are increasingly doing that. And it just feels like it's a camera that is 10 steps behind if you don't consider the sensor size as one of those considerations. Now, it is something you should consider and weigh against all of the others. But that one thing against all of the other benefits, I don't think weighs in the favor of Canon or Nikon for that matter. Even if you look at something that is a little bit more comparable, their D750, same price there. If you do an apples to apples comparison of the features of these cameras, Nikon doesn't win either.
Right now the Nikon is a full frame. The D750 is a full frame. The D500, both of those are about that same price range, and both of them are lower specs than the Fuji.
I meant to say more that the Nikon D750, in my eyes, is better than the 6D Mark II, okay. But at the same price point. But regardless of that, you know, you've got a similar class of camera.
Right.
And Nikon is doing little baby steps increasing the quality of their gear. And Fuji, Panasonic, I've got a Panasonic camera here on my desk, the GX9, which they just announced. And it is a killer camera. It's not going to be the best in low light, and it probably won't have as good autofocusing as my 1DX Mark II, but typically that's not what I'm shooting. And so I can easily push limits with any camera on the market at any price point. So why do I like my big guns, my 1DX Mark II? Well, I like a bigger, beefier camera as my main body. And this new XH1 is a bigger camera. I mean, comparative to some of the other cameras that I've held, and everybody's trying to get smaller and smaller, but I like the buttons and the dials and the features that are tangible, very tactile. And we're seeing that from Fuji here. So kudos to you, Fuji.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Canon and Nikon, I don't know any interior workings within those companies, but I think sometimes older companies that are big like that and established, they are still in the mindset of, we established the market, we set the market, and these are just gimmicks that people are doing. And they have a tendency to move slow and respond slow. And if they're not careful, you know, history is littered with these examples of companies that see the upstart coming and don't respond fast enough to do something. And you have, typically you have a lot of time to respond. But Sony is already ahead of Nikon in terms of sales, right? On camera sales. So they've already lost second place. Nikon did.
Well, and so when anybody buys a Nikon camera, they're buying Sony equipment inside of that to various different degrees anyhow. So Sony has really positioned themselves well within the market. But if I were to be talking to a new photographer, somebody that, you know, they might have their first camera, but they're not invested in any given system, you know, they can go either way. I think to myself, should I recommend Canon or Nikon to these people anymore? I mean, I shoot Canon, and I probably will for a very long time in the future because I have that investment in equipment, especially some really obscure gear that was made ages ago that fits on my Canon camera. But if I was looking for an innovative platform, something that had a better bang for the buck, you know, the Micro Four Thirds is an open standard. There's a lot of gear available for that. Fuji has some excellent lenses that can be attached to their camera, and adapters and so on and so forth. Sony, you mentioned many times, and you know, my Canon, my entire suite of Canon EF lenses will be easily adapted to a Sony camera body. So should I recommend Canon? I mean, I'm even considering that my next pro level body will be whatever the successor to the Sony A9 becomes. And that to me really kind of tells the story.
It does.
If I can't say for sure if I would recommend for somebody new to buy into the established, the old guard, then they're not going to survive the next generation of photographers. The writing is on the wall.
You know, and I've mentioned several times I'm a Nikon fan. I'm a diehard Nikon fan. I have all my gear, is all my lenses. I have some off. I have some Tamron and stuff. But this, you know, thing happened to me just 2 weeks ago. A father, his daughter is about to graduate college. He wants to buy her a camera. She wants, you know, something with, he said, where you can take the lenses on and off. And what did I recommend? And I asked, do you have any gear now? Does she have anything now? because if she already has a suite of Canon lenses or Nikon lenses or anything like that, you're pretty much going to stay where you're at then. And she had nothing. And I said, then, and don't tell my co-host this, but I said, I think you should look at Sony. Look at some of the things Sony's selling. Look at Nikon, look at Canon, but don't look at Sony as a third guy. Look at Sony as a real, one of your real choices there. And they ended up getting a Sony camera.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are making that same decision. And that's why, of course, their sales numbers are better and better. They came in, I remember when they started rolling out with their Alpha cameras. They innovated with their SLT cameras. They came out with a great product in their first two or three generations that were grossly underpriced. Just to get market share, just to say, hey, you know what? We are by far the better value. We are the same camera here, but we're 30 or 40% less in price. And that is how they've started to get entrenched into the industry. It was a brilliant strategy. And now they can start charging more if they want to, but I still find their prices to be very reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting times we live in. Everything is changing. But at the end of the day, and I've said this before, and I need to remind myself about this and everybody else, that the best images I have ever seen are taken on what I consider an antique today. It's the gear. It's the photographer behind the gear.
Absolutely.
And I can take an entry-level camera, whether it be a point-and-shoot, so long as I can, you know, fiddle with it enough, and I can make some great images. I remember my wife and I went to Cuba years ago now, but just on vacation in the wintertime. And I brought what was a sub-$100 point-and-shoot camera that at the time was about 7 or 8 years old. So this thing was just, it was marginally better than my cell phone camera. But I just wanted something that I could take, and if it gets stolen or it gets wet, it's gone and nobody's going to miss it.
Right.
And I throw some of those images into presentations randomly. And then I bring them up later in the presentation and say, hey, by the way, remember this image that you were all enjoying? This was taken on a camera that nobody would use today. You know, it is a paperweight. And they're like, oh, wow, you know, that kind of takes me back to the whole fundamentals of what photography is all about.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, definitely is the photographer, not the gear. But we all love new gear.
Oh, yes. Gear acquisition syndrome. I definitely have gas. I love new equipment. And now that I'm playing around with this this Panasonic camera, it's the first Micro Four Thirds camera that I've really considered owning. So I immediately start looking to see, well, what sort of obscure lenses might be available. There's a company that makes a 250-degree field of view fisheye lens.
Wow.
And it's designed mostly for VR purposes. But I'm thinking, I want to get my hands on that. And just do some like astrophotography stuff at that sort of an extreme angle as a circular fisheye shot. I think there could be a lot of fun had with those extremes, and no such lens available for my full frame camera. So yeah, it's, you dive into these niches and the rabbit hole just keeps going deeper and deeper. And I love the fact that, what was it, Voigtlander and a number of other companies, Zeiss has some lenses as well, but they have apertures of f0.95 on those mirrorless cameras, the Micro Four Thirds stuff. And I'm thinking, you know what, I probably would never use that on a full frame camera, but if I translate that to an appreciable you know, focal length on a Micro Four Thirds camera, then that depth of field would be comparable to the, you know, f1.4 or whatever it would be on my full frame camera. I haven't done the math to figure out the comparison, but all the options are there. So, you know, I'm still young enough that I don't have to worry about the camera weighing me down. I've hiked up mountains with 60 pounds of camera gear on my back, and I'll probably do that again at some point. But that's not for everybody. And things like this Fuji X-H1, to me, I'm not going to buy the camera, but I'm still very excited about it because it means that the industry is moving in the best possible way for competition that will usurp the Canon and Nikon kings and force all of the everybody else, the Panasonic, Olympus, Ricoh, and Pentax, and Sony to be on the same kind of competitive playing field right now. And once you've got that competitive parity for everybody vying for the top, that's where the innovation comes from, and that's what we're seeing.
And that's where us as consumers benefit. And while I'm a Nikon guy today, either Nikon keeps up the pace Or eventually I'm not a Nikon guy.
Exactly. Yeah, well said. Bonus story, because I figured that the first ones we would talk through pretty quickly. This came up just today. I saw the announcement of it. Might have been yesterday. But Kodak, back in October of 2012, discontinued their black and white film T-Max P3200. And they're bringing it back. So this is great news for the film industry, because it means that the market has not only stabilized, but is growing. And companies like Kodak are not in a declining state, but they are slowly bringing back new emulsions, or, you know, re-releasing them. And that means that they are able to push out lower volume production while still being profitable. So, well, this doesn't affect my main line of work. I shoot film just as a hobby or as a leisure activity. And the more options, the better. Mike, do you shoot film at all?
I do not, no. I don't have, my father-in-law gave me his Nikon D5, which is a film camera. And unfortunately, he left the batteries in it and it corroded and leaked all in the camera.
Oh, no.
And that was really the only film camera I had. So I have not had a film camera in years.
Well, you can clean that up if you're careful enough, and you might have to replace some components to do so. But, you know, I've got a number of film cameras. I've got the Canon EOS 1N that 35mm can use all of my Canon glass and kind of can live in that ecosystem. But I've only ever used it two or three times. I find the better joy with more vintage cameras, because to me, that's just fun. I'm not going to make money on those images.
Right.
It's the pure joy of shooting it and then spending some Zen time developing the film and scanning it. And through the wintertime, I don't really have that amount of Zen time. So I haven't done it in the last few months. But, you know, shooting film can be a wonderful way to sort of escape the monotony, the everyday, and to add just a different experience to photography. And to have something like this that Kodak states is pushable to ISO 25,000.
Wow.
I have no idea what condition it's going to be when you do that. But I mean, that's, if I shoot a digital image at ISO 25,000, it's more or less garbage. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so unusable that, you know, I'm curious to see what the film could actually be like. I'm sure somebody has done it with the previous emulsion if it's identical, and I can look up some of those results. Maybe I should do that. But the problem for me is Kodak is bringing back 35mm film. So they're bringing back this one only in the 35mm format. And the Exachrome is also coming back in movie formats and 35mm, but they're not bringing these back in the medium format or giving anybody larger options. I've got a 4x5 camera. It'd be fun to experiment with this stuff. I know those markets are smaller,
yeah,
but all of these markets are small. And so if you're bringing this back into production, it would be very advantageous, I'll say, of Kodak Alaris, if they're listening, charge me a $10 premium on a roll. Because you're not going to sell it in high volume anyhow. But wouldn't it be a fun novelty to just pick up a roll of this and experiment with it? And yeah, there's going to be a cost associated with that. But I'm not going to be shooting this in high volume. I'm not looking to make a volume purchase of 100 rolls. One or two here and there is more than enough for me to be satisfied and sort of sate my curiosity.
Yeah, on the pricing, I would think that this low ball in the price is not going to expand the market. So if they need to sell, like you said, $10, they need to charge $10 for it and can make a profit at $10, then maybe that's what they need to charge or something along the lines. There's still a market out there to be had. It's just not going to, you're not going to expand it. So what can you do to serve that market that's there? You know, can you make it one where the photographer would buy it at a price where they would buy it and at where you can sustain it and make a profit at it?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that the film market is growing partly due to nostalgia, mm-hmm, partly due to the realism that that film provides. You know, people have the illusion, and I'm going to state specifically illusion,
yeah,
that a film image is more accurate to reality. But that is still a play, right? And just the tactile experience of of shooting and scanning, or shooting and optically exposing a print too. That's something that I have never done in my career. I have never operated in a darkroom to actually make a print. Neither. It's on my bucket list. If anybody around me has an active darkroom, I would love to be schooled by you just to sit down and sort of watch you work to develop a print, because I think that would be a really fun thing. I'm all for elements of photography that are outside of my comfort zone, that if I could spend an hour a day learning that, it might give me new creative ideas or inspiration, or that aha moment that I can connect different puzzle pieces together with. I remember the first day that I spent with my 4x5 camera. I took three pictures and they all sucked. But I loved the experience and I learned a lot from the entire process. When I shoot snowflakes and a lot of the macro stuff that I've done before and time and again, I don't really learn anything in the process. I might get some new ideas, but the techniques are solidified. Everything is known and common to me. But when I pick up a film camera, I'm like, okay, how do I figure out what the proper exposure is going to be? You know, if I take this Leica 3F that I have sitting on my desk and try to use that, or a Rolitoscope, which is a 3D medium format camera, it's all mechanical. It's all manual. And I've oftentimes took a digital camera along, did a test shot at the exposure settings that That's I thought cheating. Would work and said, yeah, that looks good. Let's dial that into the film camera instead of going all the way and getting a light meter and carrying that process through to its normal, natural, intended end. And so there's room for growth there, I think. And, you know, I was in Michael's, the craft mm-hmm. store, the other day. Behind the counter, I saw them selling a typewriter.
Really?
There is somebody manufacturing typewriters now. I have an old Underwood number 5 from 1914 sitting on one of my back desks here. So that probably had some letters written during World War I, and it's got a lot of history to it. And I've banged off a couple of old letters on that thing and mailed them to people if I really wanted to have a response from them. Because who mails a letter these days, let alone one that has the paper notably dented by an antique typewriter? So there's some value to that. I don't use it regularly. I haven't used it this year. But people take notice when that is used. And I don't think the typewriter market is going to have much of a resurgence.
No.
I think that there's more in the used inventory than the world will ever put to use. And the same is true of film cameras, even though some people try to make new ones. But you still need the film. You still need the typewriter ribbons. Maybe that will have a new company come up and allow, you know, purple for me to type on.
There's always a love affair with, you know, nostalgic things like that. You know, not just from the old who are remembering back when they used to use it, but from some of the younger people who want to try something different, do something different. You know, you talked about developing film. I've never done that. And if we live closer, we could ride together to go to whoever's going to show us how to do this. I'd love to see that, just like you mentioned, and, you know, watch that process, because I've never seen it. But I don't own a typewriter.
I've developed film, I should say. You know, and it's easy to do daylight developing of a film. You just buy a little tank for a couple of bucks and the chemicals that you need. And the massive dev chart, which has apps for iOS and Android, will give you all of the timings that you need for developing with different chemicals at different dilutions. And it's easy. You just follow the steps, A, B, and C, and you're done. But the art of making a print with an enlarger, I think that is something that I need to explore at some point, because that is a complete unknown for me. But anyhow, that is our final story. So as we're winding down, you know, I forgot to mention this to you, Mike, because you are a last minute co-host replacement here, because I had a cancellation.
Yeah.
But I'm now doing sort of a pick of the week sort of thing, where if you have anything geeky or interesting that you might have seen, that you might have used, that is related to photography, then you can make mention of that here. I've got one that I use on a regular basis when I'm dealing with my macro photography, my focus stacking specifically. And a lot of flashes will have a little port on the side that allow you to plug in an extra battery pack. And so I've got, this is the Canon CP-E4, but there's a lot of knockoffs, and Canon has the E4N, which apparently has some circuitry that prevents overheating. I'm not sure if it's helpful to you or not, but it has 8 extra AA batteries in it. So on my flashes, I can configure it to either use the 4 batteries inside the flash to operate the flash electronics and just charge the capacitors with these extra 8, or go all in and have 12 batteries, wow, both operating the flash and charging the capacitors. So when I'm photographing snowflakes and I'm doing things that require a quick repetition of exposures, my shutter speed on my camera, or my rate of fire, I should say, without this, is far faster than my flash can keep up with. And so I just tuck this little thing in my pocket and have another cord running to my camera. And when I'm out in the garden photographing bees fluttering about from flower to flower, and I'm shooting at a very high rate of speed, the flash can keep up with me. And it's not an expensive thing to add to your camera gear. If you've ever gotten dark frames because the flash did not fire when you're out shooting, right, just get one of these little battery packs. It will save you.
That is super cool. I do not have anything prepared for that. The last thing I bought is so much low tech, much more low tech than that. It was a monopod. I bought a new monopod that I'm loving the monopod. It's way over there in the corner. I don't remember the name of it, but it's, you know, it's six section that you can collapse pretty small. It's a carbon fiber monopod that is, you know, low tech, but if you need a monopod, this thing folds up into, I don't know, maybe a foot long, but mm-hmm. then can unfold into, you know, 6 foot, and fits in the camera bag just awesomely, and can hold up my camera, you know, really well. It's, you know, monopods are low tech, but
there's a lot of uses for a monopod that I've shot at weddings, you know, mostly just family and friends and things like that. I don't do them professionally, but yeah, one of the trick shots that I like to do is to put a fisheye lens on my camera, set it on a 10-second timer, and hoist it up over the dance floor when everybody is dancing to the height of the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having a monopod that can get you 6 feet, you know, that's exactly what you need. You hoist it up, you hope you've got it pointed accurately, but with a fisheye lens, you know, even if you're off by a bit, you still have the action. And I'll take a couple of shots like that. I wish my camera had a built-in intervalometer, like a lot of these new small ones do, which mm-hmm. is a huge advantage, because I could just hold it up there for a minute or so and just get a bunch of really cool frames of everybody dancing about. You get the people sitting around that are watching, especially if it's right after the first dances and the bride and the groom are out there dancing about. It's a great use for a monopod.
It is, yeah.
What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, in for me, I do a lot of sports photography. So this also, not only is it smaller and lighter weight and everything else, but, and I will get the name of it here in just a second. But because it's smaller, let's say you're shooting smaller kids, whatever sport it is, and you want to sit on the ground, now that smaller monopod can come down and be at your height. My other one, which was a Gitzo, you know, aluminum one, I think the shortest it went was maybe like 3 feet. You can't sit on the ground and get more closer to the eye level of your, you know, the kids and take photos that way with that size of a monopod. So you need that shorter monopod.
And harder to carry around with you if you're trying to travel light as well. I was going to mention that recently when I was in Bulgaria, which is my wife's home country, and we travel there every year, we visited the former Communist Party headquarters during the era of the Soviet Union. We've been there twice. Buzulja is the name of it. Rolls right off the tongue. It's questionably legal whether or not you should go inside, although I met more English-speaking people inside this building than I had anywhere else in the country. It's a bit of an odd tourist attraction for urban exploration. The most beautifully destroyed building that I've ever been into, but we climbed up a tower that's attached to this building that is like 27 flights of rusted out metal stairs in this concrete coffin almost, because there's no lights or anything. You've got to have flashlights or headlamps. And we got up to the top, and I looked over the side of this tower, and I thought, I have to take a picture here. So I didn't have a monopod, but I had my tripod, and I fully extended the legs, but I had them all bunched up together. Mm-hmm. And I fished it over the edge as far as I could, and took a photograph of the tower leading into this beautiful Balkan mountain landscape. And a monopod would have been the better solution for that. I wasn't traveling with one. So, monopod, again, I am singing its praises.
And the brand was, SIRUI, Siru.
Siru.
Siru. SIRUI.
Siroui. But we'll put a link in the show notes to this so that people can go and check it out. And I think that it's an advantage to have, especially if that kind of gear, it's not going to be the price of a new lens. I mean, how much did this set you back?
$97 on Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not something that you would just go out and buy five of, you know, but for the cost of it, I think it's a valuable ingredient to have in your photographic tool belt.
Cool. Yep. I'm loving it. Yep.
Thank you, Mike. So with that new monopod and anything else, you said that your work, you're in the IT industry, right?
I am both in the IT and accounting, so I do both of those.
That sounds more stressful than photography. There can be some crisis modes that are very difficult and tricky. I'm guessing photography is your de-stressor for all that, right?
It is. Yes, it is my de-stressor. You mentioned weddings or whatever. I will never do weddings because of the stress. For me, photography is not a way of making a living or anything like that. For me, photography is my de-stressor. It is where I have fun, and it's totally a hobby for me.
So,
and I have no desire to do anything but have it be a hobby.
Good. But at the same time, you've got a very successful podcast and a lot of people listen. And so again, that is the JPEG to RAW podcast, spelled with an E, right?
Yep. Yep.
All right.
Although without an E, we'll still get you there.
Okay. Good enough. What is the next big thing that you're planning on, whether it has to do with the podcast or with your photographic endeavors?
Well, I am going to Alaska here coming up in a few months. So that is the next big thing for me. So I got to get that camera sent off and fixed before we head out to Alaska. And looking forward to that. So that's the next big thing for me.
Whereabouts in Alaska are you going?
I don't know all the places, but I know we're starting in Juneau and then heading up from there.
You're doing a whole tour. That's great. Now, I've been to the Yukon twice, and it is addictive, I guess, would be the only word that can describe it. You can never have enough of it. The only times that I've been disconnected from the world is when I was with a hunting party, and we went out like 9 hours, 9.5 hours away from Whitehorse. And so we are hours away from civilization. And no cell phone connection. I went through withdrawal. And for like 2 or 3 days, I was like constantly checking my phone when there was no signal. And then you have a certain sense of clarity, just like a serenity and a focus on what you're doing. And then when it comes towards the end of that trip, you know, 72 hours before I know I'm going to be reconnected, I start to get the itch again. Start thinking, okay, well, who's emailed me? What images am I going to post first to social media? It sounds like you'll still be connected where you're going, though, if you're hitting the bigger cities.
Yeah. You know, maybe it's a couple of years ago, we did a show with Ron Clifford about Antarctica. And during that show, I guess one of my coworkers heard it, and he is actually in Antarctica right now. That is a place on my bucket list. I'd love to go to Antarctica, but I don't see that realistically happening anytime soon.
Well, you know, Ron has gone a number of times, I think, to Antarctica. He lives close to me, and I had him sitting in my backyard talking about one of his adventures there this past summer. And it's on my bucket list too, because, you know, it's been done before. The places that you're going, you're typically going to go with a group of photographers that are going to get very similar shots to yours. Mm-hmm. And they take that same group of photographers or the same numbers there on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day. So the same is true of Iceland and all these other wonderful places. That still doesn't deter my lust to go and explore these beautiful icebergs and, you know, photograph the penguins and just the landscapes and the atmosphere. I can make that my own personal project. Probably not going to be able to monetize much of it because there is so much of it out there, but it would still be a very enjoyable process. Just expensive to get out there.
Iceland's a lot more achievable as far as cost and you know, getting there between that and Antarctica.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's sign off for the day. This has been a great chat. Thank you for being here, Mike. Just a reminder, you're welcome anytime. We have to get to parody at some point here. I've got to have you on at least two more times. You know, just a reminder to everybody that this podcast is weekly. And it is a labor of love for me. But if you want to give me a few dollars, we have a tip jar on the website. And we are supported by Patreon. So if you want to give us a continuing donation to buy me a coffee or a beer or whatever you'd like, if you want to specify, Don, go buy yourself X beverage. I will take the money and I will go and do just that. But I do like to stay caffeinated, especially when it comes to editing these podcasts. So thanks everybody for listening. We are now up to around 2,000 listeners an episode, and we are only at episode 15 so far. So I am absolutely thrilled by that. I hope it continues to grow. Tell your friends, subscribe, and get out and shoot.